You're listening to Radio Times Rewind. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. Madeleine Albright was born into a Jewish family in Czechoslovakia in the 1930s. Her father was a diplomat and strong proponent of democracy. Shortly after her birth, the family went into exile in Great Britain to escape the Nazis. After the war, when the communists took over Czechoslovakia, the family was granted political asylum by the United States. The geopolitics of her youth were a fitting beginning for someone who would grow up to become America's ambassador to the United Nations before becoming its first female Secretary of State, picked for the role by President Bill Clinton in 1997. In her 2003 memoir titled Madam Secretary, Albright details how she went from an immigrant to a power player in D.C., as well as a role in several foreign policy crises of the 1990s, including Somalia, Rwanda, Yugoslavia, and the Middle East. We start here as Albright answers my question about what she set out to accomplish with her memoir.
You write in the preface to this book that you wanted this memoir to be different from other secretaries of state, and you wanted to combine the personal with the policy. Is that something you think that women do more than men, or is that something about you?
Well, I do think that women do it more than men because I think we see our life as a whole and we don't try to separate various parts of it. But I also thought it was very important for people to know who I am, given the kinds of decisions that I made, and understand that I am an immigrant, that it took me a while as a woman to put my career together. So I do think that I wasn't like other secretaries of state, so that's why I thought I'd do a different kind of memoir.
Well, you're an immigrant with no discernible accent.
Well, I grew up in England. I did have a very English accent, and I remember so well the first Thanksgiving. We were in Great Neck, New York, and we were singing We Gather Together, and all of a sudden I heard somebody asking God's blessing while the other people were asking, and I quickly lost my very British accent.
And sounded like an American.
Sounded like an American, which is what I wanted to be more than anything else, was to grow up an American.
Well, I was surprised to read that you said you were never supposed to be what you became. As a young woman, what did you think your life was going to be?
Well, I had no idea. You know, I could have just grown up in Czechoslovakia and been the daughter of a diplomat, probably a professor. I could have stayed there under a communist regime in which I would have hoped I would have been a dissident. I could have been a happily married woman with three children who did a lot of volunteer work. But it all turned out quite differently, and I've loved every part of it.
Well, it seems as if a turning point for you was the divorce that you got from your husband, and this was a divorce, I guess, that he handed you. He wanted to actually leave you. What was the impact on you at that time?
Well, I was stunned, to say the least. I'd been married for 23 years, and I thought happily with a husband who had been truly supportive of everything that I'd done, getting my PhD for an overly long period of time, my various escapades in political campaigns, and then working for Senator Muskie, and then in the White House. He had always been very supportive, but all of a sudden he arrived and said he was in love with somebody else, and it was a stunning shock. I do think it drove me to work harder. At first, I think just to kind of stay busy because my kids were grown up, one thing led to another. I have a very hard part in the book where I still can't figure out exactly how I respond to it.
Well, let me just read a couple of lines from that, because it struck me as well. There are many contradictions in the way that I feel, and this was about the divorce. When I became Secretary of State, I realized that though others might, I would never have climbed that high had I still been married. Yet I was deeply saddened to have been divorced. I know at the time that I would have given up any thought of a career if I would have made Joe change his mind.
Well, that is how it really was, and I would have given up anything, because I was trying to analyze what it is that made him leave, and whether it was because I had a career, which I resent even the thought of. As I said, I hate being asked that question, but I don't know the answer to it. I loved being Secretary of State, and so it is kind of a contradiction in my own head.
Well, he gave you a curious ultimatum, and it had to do with a Pulitzer Prize, whether he was going to win or lose it, and that was going to decide the fate of this marriage.
Well, it was really strange, and when I wrote that down, my editor said, "Are you kidding?" But that is what happened, and I think only he can explain why that kind of trade-off existed.
And he said if he was a journalist, if he had won the Pulitzer Prize, he would have stayed married.
That is what he said, or married to me. Anyway.
Married to you.
And I think that it had a lot to do with his baggage and his life. And at first, I like so many women, I thought the whole thing was my fault. But the more that I analyzed it, I think it obviously takes two people, and there's a lot in his background, I think, that made this happen.
Well, this is something that happened 20 years ago, and yet you also write about after he left, going to a supermarket and not being sure what kind of cereal you liked because you had spent so much time trying to, I guess, feed your family and give them what they liked.
Well, the reason I decided to write so honestly this particular chapter, which is very personal, is that I think other women and men have gone through this, and you begin to think of yourself as a we and make decisions that are only based on how other people feel rather than on your own thoughts. And to me, it was so symptomatic of the fact that I honestly didn't know whether I liked shredded wheat or Cheerios, and I didn't like steak, which is what I'd been eating for 23 years.
And you figured that out.
Yeah. I mean, it isn't exactly brain surgery, but it was an issue of trying to figure out how to make decisions on my own.
There's a quote you gave to the New York Times, a reporter, Elaine Scalino, where you said, "I'm not that smart. I work very hard." Is that a true description of you, do you think?
Well, I was told that it was not a good quote and that it was picked up in a way that was misunderstood. I think it's quite a girl thing to say. So I regret saying it because I actually think I'm pretty smart. But I do work hard. I really do work hard. And, Hillary Clinton said to me, "Why did you say something like that when we know you're smart?"
And it's a girl thing because girls underestimate their abilities?
I think so. You know, I think we basically are unsure of ourselves many times. And when a woman is sure of herself, then she's criticized and called a lot of names that probably are not appropriate on radio.
You talk about being female U.S. ambassador to the United Nations and then Secretary of State and being asked about dealing with the sexism around the world. And you have an interesting comment about that, essentially that dealing with the old boys network in the United States was a lot harder than dealing with men in Arab countries, to use the stereotype.
Yes, because, you know, when I dealt with foreign men, especially those in Arab countries, they knew that if they were going to talk to the United States, I was the Secretary of State. I was the channel through which to talk. I did arrive in a large plane that said United States of America
that
on
helps, it, isn't it?
Which did help. But they knew there I was. I was the United States for that particular time. Whereas the men in my own government, not that they were nasty people, I have to say that. I mean, they basically are all kind, generous people. But I think, in my own explanation, is I think they'd known me too long through a variety of different stages. They knew me as a wife. They knew me as somebody that was a friend of their wife's or the carpool mother or a staffer for Senator Muskie, and not somebody all of a sudden that kind of leapt over them and became the first woman Secretary of State. So it made in some of them kind of a sense of being a little dismissive of what I had to say, or if I felt strongly about something, which I often did, I was called emotional, whereas I think a man would be called, really confident and convinced. And I ran into something that I think many, many women run into. This was not unusual.
How did you learn that President Clinton wanted you to be his UN secretary?
Well, I did not believe I would become Secretary of State. And some of my friends, my chief of staff, Elaine Shoka, said, "Yes, you will," and I just did not believe it, because there's a lot of competition. There had been an article in the paper which said I was second tier, which obviously made me mad and made a lot of women mad. But I couldn't rely on the fact that President Clinton would name me just because I was a woman, because he'd already named Janet Reno to the highest level position, and he had really elevated many women in the administration, so I couldn't count on that. But the way I learned about it was that one night, Erskine Bowles, who was the chief of staff, called me. I was in New York doing my job, and he said, "If the president of the United States were to call you tomorrow, would you take the call? And if he were to ask you to be Secretary of State, would you say yes?" And I thought, who in God's name would say no to either of those questions? And he said, well, go to Washington, and he'll call you early in the morning. So I rushed down there, and then forgetting that I was dealing with Bill Clinton, who didn't start real early in the morning, I waited. I didn't even take a shower. I sat there in my pink terry cloth bathrobe waiting for the call, which at 9:47 finally came. The White House operator said, hold for the president. Then some horrible music came on. And then I thought, he's changed his mind. He's definitely changed his mind. And he's calling to tell me he's changed his mind. And he got on the phone. He said, I want you to be my Secretary of State, which is the first time that I really believed it.
Wow. And that does make you then the highest ranking female in the American government ever.
Yes. And it was I was so proud to be Secretary of State, and especially since I hadn't been born here. I mean, it really was something I hoped that I could spend my time as secretary repaying the generosity of the American people for allowing me to grow up here.
Kissinger said, welcome to the fraternity.
That was very funny because he hadn't even known what he said. And I said, you know, Henry, it's not a fraternity anymore.
Well, even before that, you were the U.S. representative at the United Nations, dealing with many things, which you write about in the book, including Somalia, including Rwanda, and of course, later on in Kosovo as well. What did you learn about the United Nations that you think prepared you for its Secretary of State?
Well, first of all, there the vast number of issues with which we dealt, because it really required me to learn a lot about all the places that we were dealing with. So it was incredibly good grounding. It also made me understand the views of other countries, because I dealt with more different kinds of foreigners per square inch than any other American representative. I mean, the ambassador to Germany dealt with more Germans, for instance, but I dealt with this variety of people. And the only way I can describe it was that you could see the effect of a decision that you made, how it affected vast numbers of countries. So it's a little bit like a pool table where you hit one ball, it hits a bunch of others, and there are all kinds of effects that come from a particular policy. So it made me understand the importance of multilateral diplomacy and the difficulties of it and the worthwhileness of it.
This goes back to your time at the United Nations, but I guess the first international crisis you had to deal with was with Somalia, with Mogadishu, a humanitarian crisis there, a country, if not in civil war, certainly on the brink of civil war. And after a series of terrible mishaps, 18 American soldiers died, some 100 were injured, and one dead soldier dragged around the streets of Mogadishu. What happened in Somalia that you think led to what? Well, I guess what led up to the policy, at least the United Nations, that led to this disaster on the streets of Mogadishu?
Well, the first Bush administration decided that they wanted to have a humanitarian action. As you remember, there were people starving in Somalia, and it quickly turned into much more of a political activity. When we came into office, we felt the U.S. was there, that it needed to be turned over to the United Nations. We then asked, I think, the United Nations to do more than we ourselves had done, which was to disarm the various warlords, and the U.N. did not have enough troops to do it. What added to the confusion was that the U.S. actually were the commanders of the U.N. forces, and so the division between what was U.S. responsibility and U.N. responsibility became very clouded, and basically, we were then hunting down this man, Adid, who was the major warlord, and got ambushed. And it was a huge tragedy, and was very hard because I don't think we had explained sufficiently to the American people what it was that we were doing there. And so it was a failure. I think primarily the UN gets blamed for it, but it was primarily an American failure. And there were many lessons learned from it.
Well, you're right. We had not provided the means to achieve the goals we had set, and some brave Americans died. Do you think it was a mistake to withdraw from Somalia? And I ask that only because I believe it was Osama bin Laden and other terrorists have said, using Somalia as an example, that Americans are not willing to stand and fight, that they saw this as a form of weakness.
Well, I think in retrospect, it does seem that way, although at the time it was something that was agreed that we should do because it wasn't properly explained. But the reason that I spent as much time on this UN chapter was in order for people to understand the challenges that were there, When we arrived at the UN, there were 70,000 peacekeepers out in the field. The operations center at the UN was primitive, to say the least, and the question was, how did the U.S. operate within peacekeeping operation? What was the chain of command? How big a role did we play? What did other countries do? And those were the questions that we were dealing with at the time, and I just think that we were probably unprepared to deal with the challenges, and it reflected in other areas. But we ultimately learned.
Well, and comparing Somalia and Rwanda, the lessons of Somalia, you're saying dealing with anarchy was to go cautiously. Rwanda, you were dealing with mass murder, which really required action. Yet there was no action.
Well, this is I think it's one of the worst periods, and also one that is misunderstood a great deal. And it has to be seen in the context of what was going on. We were in Bosnia, we'd had the disaster in Somalia, and Rwanda, there had been a United Nations operation there, but it began to be under fire, and there were calls for its withdrawal. The Belgians were the lead country. They were a NATO ally. They wanted to get out. And I got instructions, and I was at that time what you call an instructed ambassador, to support the withdrawal of the force. I could tell from the discussion that that was the wrong position. And so I quickly called for a change in instructions, which I ultimately got. Mm-hmm. But the truth is that I don't think we could have stopped the genocidal killing, because it happened after the airplane of the Hutu president of Rwanda had been shot down. And all of a sudden there was a volcanic explosion of genocidal killing. And I think even if we'd managed to put ourselves together, we couldn't have gotten there on time. But I wish that I had stood stronger. It wouldn't have made a difference, but my soul would have felt better.
President Clinton apologized. You have apologized. Does that help assuage some of the doubts you have about what happened?
Probably not, you know, but I, in looking at it logically, which is difficult in a situation like this, there were no forces available to go quickly enough, which leads me to advocate the fact that we should have forces at the ready, not just the U.S., but other countries that are ready to intervene in a humanitarian situation. And we did, in fact, then begin training of African forces so that they would know what to do when they were just summoned to get together.
Well, I'm sorry. No, go ahead.
No, and I think there is a real question about what role the United States plays in all these peacekeeping operations. And I happen to believe that we should use them more often because it shares the burden. But it is a serious problem, a question.
But do these two tests of the United Nations, would you say, and essentially the United Nations failed, does that tell you that it's a body that really cannot deal with crises around the world?
Well, we failed. Because
we meaning the United States.
We and other powerful countries, because the United Nations is nothing more than us. And if there is not the political will of the nation states, it won't happen. There are those who believe that the UN should have its own standing army. I don't believe that, because you do need to have countries actually commit themselves to doing something. But what would be useful would be if the UN also managed to train what I call kind of a more powerful police force. Because if you look at what's happening in Iraq now or in other places, you don't always need a tank. And you can't just do with a policeman with a nightstick. You need something in between where the police forces are needed. And I think there is a role for more international help in that.
Well, let's take some phone calls. And let me just quickly reintroduce you. And if you're just joining us, our guest today on Radio Times is Secretary of State Madeleine Albright. She was Secretary of State during the Clinton administration. And she has a new book about her life and about her years and tenure in the Clinton administration called Madam Secretary. One open line at 1-888-477-9499. We have Lisa. And Lisa joins us from Morrisville,
Hello.
Pennsylvania. Hi, Lisa. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. I was wondering how Madam Secretary,
hi,
so even tempered and civil, and you know, like she said, she was in a room with us speaking to Henry Kissinger, and I told the screener I don't think I could be in the same room with Henry Kissinger. So I was wondering how she managed to do that.
Well, that's probably why you're not Secretary of
yeah,
State, Lisa.
Yeah, never will be.
Go ahead.
Well, I think it's very important to realize that there are people that you have to deal with. Actually, Henry Kissinger's not such a bad person, and we talk a lot about foreign policy. There are a lot of people that are hard to be in the room with, but you do have to control yourself because you have a job, and you have to figure out when to be really tough and tell it like it is and when occasionally trying to be charming.
Who is tough to be with in the room with? I'm curious.
Well, I think that it's very hard to be with Yasser Arafat, who doesn't seem to get the point. And it's very hard to have dealt with, for instance, some of the leader of Congo who didn't understand what we were trying to do, or just generally some tough dictators. One of the hardest meetings I had was with the dictatorship in Burma, where this man called Kin Yut, who was telling me that they were treating Aung San Suu Kyi perfectly well, and that's very hard. I kind of let him have a piece of my mind, but you have to be very careful in how you say what you say in order to have the strongest effect. But I was pretty tough, and I would say something like, I have come a long way, so I must be frank. Mm-hmm. And then I really let him have it.
And does frankness work better than yelling and screaming?
I think so. I think once you yell, it's a problem, though there obviously is a lot of play acting in diplomacy. I mean, sometimes you've had it and you throw your papers down on the table and say, I'm leaving, I can't, you know, I'm not going to deal with you. And that sometimes works. But you can't let it be real, because if it gets real, then it gets in your way. You cannot let personal pique get in the way of diplomacy.
Lisa, thanks for calling in. Let me get to Vincent from Center City, Philadelphia. Go ahead, Vincent. You're on Radio Times.
Yeah, real pleasure to talk to the Madam Secretary.
Thank you.
Madam Secretary, I'm not going to ask you anything about the New York Stock Exchange, but I do have two questions for you.
Go ahead.
Our policy in Iraq, Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld has steadfastly said we need a lighter, faster, more mobile army, and we're not going to put more than 140,000 troops in there. However, the Army Chief of Staff, General Shinyeki, had warned way back before we even went in there that we would need 700,000-800,000 men to really secure the borders and so forth. And what I'd like to ask you is that now that we're going through the reserves, the National Guardsmen, and so forth, that it seems like it's going to be difficult to maintain a troop level without perhaps bringing in the draft. And surely, if we had the amount of military men over there that we need and women, we would probably have to bring back the draft. Do you think that the administration is playing presidential election politics with this, the way they're doing the Iraq war? Because surely, if they had to maintain 400,000 or 500,000 troops in there, a draft would be called for. Charles Rangel, the ranking New York congressman, has called for a draft so that we could all share the burden. And
well, Vincent, let me find out what Secretary Albright has to say. And thank you for calling in. It's an interesting question.
It is. And one of the hard parts in terms of getting the reserve and the National Guard is that under Homeland Security, they are the first responders in terms of if something happens at home. So I think it is a serious problem. I have had discussions with some military friends about the draft, and I think they generally feel that it is better to have an all-volunteer army, that we had so many inequities that happened during Vietnam with the draft that they would like to stay away from it. I do think that there is some problem in terms of the numbers that Secretary Rumsfeld decided on, and generally somebody like General Shinseki would have some more accurate numbers, though often, if I may say so, sometimes some of the military people up the numbers so that they then make it impossible, say the numbers are so large that then you never decide to do anything. So this is a very tough call. I do think that we are being stretched thin, which is why we have to get help from some other countries and why I think that the diplomacy going into the war was mishandled.
That was Madeleine Albright speaking with me in 2003. In just a moment, we'll be back with more Radio Times Rewind, including Albright's take on accusations that some of the Clinton administration's foreign policy decisions were about wagging the dog to distract from the president's impeachment. This is Radio Times Rewind. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Let's get back to my 2003 interview with Madeleine Albright, America's first female Secretary of State. We start here with her discussing a dispute she had as UN ambassador with Colin Powell, who was then chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, over the use of American military force in Bosnia.
Well, I want to just actually go back a little time to Bosnia and conversation you had with Colin Powell, and this was really arguing over policy in, I guess it was Kosovo.
No, Bosnia.
Bosnia, and what kind of force to use. And you said to Colin Powell, what are you saving the superb military for, Colin, if we can't use it? He then wrote in his biography, or autobiography, that question, I guess, gave him a near heart attack as you raised the question. But what were you saying to him?
Well, what I was saying is that there was ethnic cleansing taking place in Bosnia, and I believed that it was possible with a limited application of force to change what was happening. He had just been through the Gulf War, where the doctrine of overwhelming force was what seemed to be popular. And part of the problem, and this was the discussion, was he was chairman of the Joint Chiefs at the time, and whenever we asked how many forces it would take to do something, he would explain in great detail that it could be done, but it would take huge numbers of forces, and we probably wouldn't prevail, and what would happen if somebody died. So that, in an effect, made it impossible to use a force, which I don't believe in. I think that I am for peace, but I'm not a pacifist, and we have to figure out what the right amount of force is, which is why it's very hard, I think, to decide on what the right numbers are. But anyway, Colin Powell, by the time his book came out, we had in fact used force and we had won. And so I did call him and ask him what he thought. And, you know, we just have different views. We did win in Kosovo and in Bosnia with the limited application of force.
Well, you said that I did think, however, then as now, that the lessons of Vietnam could be learned too well.
Well, and I think that we have to take each situation separately. I happen to believe it's important to stand up for what we believe in, but I think we have to choose our wars, and I thought that while I understood why Iraq, I didn't understand why now. This was a war of choice, and I think that it wasn't planned very well.
Well, I wonder if for you there are some parallels, because you were criticized for a policy in Bosnia, in Kosovo, the bombing campaign there. Many people called this Madeleine's War. And I wonder whether you think there's some parallels to the kind of criticisms that the Bush administration is getting today about their policy in Iraq.
Well, I imagine they would like to say that, but no, I don't. I mean, I think that Iraq, if you looked at it, I had said I understood the why of the war because Saddam Hussein was all those things. But we had him in a strategic box with bombing in the no-fly zones and the sanctions. And I thought that we needed to concentrate more on Afghanistan, where the terrorism had really started and where the people who flew into the Twin Towers came from, and that fighting terrorism there was the important thing. In Kosovo, we were watching thousands of people being ethnically cleansed, and it made sense in terms of trying to apply a limited amount of air war, and we won it. So you have to look at it from different perspective, and I just thought that the Iraq war at this time was a diversion from what we should have been doing, is fighting in Afghanistan.
But now that we're there, are you afraid we'll stay too long or we'll leave too quickly?
At the moment, I'm afraid that we might leave too quickly, because it's a chaotic situation. And while I did not believe there was a connection between Saddam Hussein and Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda, as we were told initially, I now do think that the chaotic situation in Iraq has created a gathering ground, if not a magnet, for all these various people who hate us. And if we were to withdraw too quickly, take the lesson of Somalia, for instance, I think that it would undermine our credibility. Mm-hmm. But what we do need to do is get help from others. If they don't want to send their own forces, they need to help us train the Iraqi police and the Iraqi army. We need to begin to turn this over to the Iraqis.
Let me get to Valerie from Westchester to join us. Valerie, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, Madam Secretary, my question has to do with the increasing involvement in the democratic process in the United States. Do you think it would be possible to use some internet-based opinion process to allow our representatives to get the pulse of the people by us going on in the internet, expressing our opinion in some way that gets aggregated in a, you know, a voting type process.
Well, Valerie, I think a lot of members of Congress have websites and places you can go and leave messages and voice your opinion. I'm not sure if you're calling for something more than that, but I'm just curious, Madam
Secretary,
what you think.
Well, I do think that there's more and more information coming through the internet and websites, and a lot of polling that is done off of that. And I think you're seeing it in a number of campaigns that have much more of this internet roots, not grassroots, aspect to them. And it's a new form of technology that I think is being used pretty well.
Valerie, thanks for calling in. Are there any presidential candidates that interest you?
Well, a lot of them do. But I, as you described, I used to be very active in Democratic politics. I still am, but I don't think that it I'm going to endorse at this point. I have been called by most of the candidates for advice, which I'm delighted to give, and I would like us to come up with the strongest possible candidate.
I want to just read you some comments that Condoleezza Rice made recently, where she talked about this U.S. war on terrorism. And I'm just quoting here actually from the New York Times. She said on Thursday, and this is a couple weeks ago, that the Clinton and other past administrations had ignored evidence of growing terrorist threats, and that despite repeated attacks on American interests, quote, until September 11th, the terrorists faced no sustained systemic or global response from the United States, quote, they became emboldened, and the result was more terror and more victims. I'm curious what your response is to that, essentially blaming the Clinton administration for not doing enough to deal with the problem of terrorism.
Well, it's I at the time that I read it, I thought she was trying to divert attention from the mess that's going on in Iraq now. I spent a lot of time on the issue of terrorism at the time that we were in office. President Clinton warned about it all the time. We managed, in fact, to avert some incidents that are not known about because they're the dogs that didn't bark. When, in fact, our embassies were blown up in Kenya and Tanzania, we launched cruise missiles against Afghanistan and practically almost got Osama bin Laden. And we bombed a factory in Sudan that was affiliated with him. And if you remember, Marty, people thought we were overreacting. And one of the things was that when the new administration was briefed about the amount of time that we spent fighting and looking at terrorism, they were a little surprised about it themselves. And so I actually think that finger-pointing is not useful. I feel comfortable with what, at the time, I felt comfortable with what we were doing given the intelligence that we had. And in reviewing the documentation for my book, I really think we did everything we could. And Osama bin Laden, we tried to get there. Now 8,000 troops, American troops in Afghanistan, and they haven't found him. So it's a hard job. And I think that we all need to be supportive of the president in fighting terrorism, which is why I'm concerned about Iraq, because we should have kept our eye on the ball in Afghanistan.
One of the criticisms of the Clinton administration at that time was that this was a wag the dog policy, because this was during or around the time of the Clinton impeachment and this policy seen as a diversion from all the problems here at home. What's your response to that?
Well, that was one of the things that was very uncomfortable, because we were reacting in the appropriate way, and I knew that it was not a wag the dog, that it was something that had to be done because the way that our embassies had been attacked. And I have to tell you that despite the fact that it was clearly a difficult time, it did not affect the way that we made foreign policy or my job as Secretary of State, because the president was completely focused on foreign policy. We had some very serious and good talks, for instance, on the Israelis and Palestinians in the fall of 1998. So while it was not a good time, it did not affect foreign policy.
Do you, though, in any way blame the president for his reckless behavior and its impact on at least the perception of foreign policy?
Well, I think that it did not have that much even of perception. You know, the interesting thing is that there was a meeting of the United Nations General Assembly that fall, and the president spoke. He got a standing ovation, which doesn't happen except for Nelson Mandela, and it was, I think, basically a sign by the foreigners that they thought that we were crazy.
And crazy so, to be so
wrapped up in it. And I think that there were a few people that had this wag-the-dog perception, but I think on the whole, it did not affect the way that we did foreign policy or were perceived abroad in doing foreign policy.
Are you angry that he lied to you and others about what was going on?
Well, I did say that I thought it risked a lot for nothing. And we had a rather bizarre meeting that I described when the president got the cabinet together to apologize. And he got diverted by talking about how angry he was. I thought it was the whole thing was strange, and that the cabinet is not really set up to be a confessor to the president. And I think we all had our different views of it. And I think it was a huge sadness and tragedy for the Clinton family. But it was something that we just wanted to keep working.
Let's get back to our callers. And we have Rachel, who's calling us from University City. Rachel, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. I'm actually a student of international relations at the University of Pennsylvania, and actually, Madam Secretary, you're one of my my heroes.
Thank you.
A thrill.
Go ahead.
But I'm writing my thesis on the role of the UN in the HIV/AIDS epidemic in China, and I wanted to ask you what you felt the role of UNAIDS and the U.S. should be in that epidemic.
Well, I think that
it's
a very important paper to write, and I'm glad you're doing it. I think Secretary General Kofi Annan is trying to lead a global attack on HIV/AIDS, and it is very important to support him in that. One of the questions has been is whether the money that President Bush pledged, the $50 million, whether it really, one, was going to come through, and why was it not done through the U.N.? And I think that is a legitimate question to ask, and also as you're writing your paper to follow how much of the money has actually been voted, because it's one thing to pledge it, it's another to have it really happen. President Clinton is in China as we speak, and he is talking about the fact that they have to admit and deal with HIV/AIDS. The most successful work against it has been in countries in Africa, for instance in Uganda, where President Museveni has really come out and said that something has to be done about it. It's called the big noise, rather than basically saying it doesn't exist. And for China, it's now a matter of admitting that they are on the verge of a pandemic.
Well, and good luck with your paper, Rachel. Let me get Lud from Voorhees to join us. Lud, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, Madam Secretary. This is kind of a follow-up to Marty's question on the situation that happened after the embassy bombings. The GOP complaint, of course, was that the response was, in retrospect, was too weak.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering if you could comment if there were stronger options considered by the Clinton administration at the time, and what the reaction might have been from the GOP Congress. Thank you.
Well,
thanks.
Thank you. Well, let me say this, is that we were prepared to act if there ever had been intelligence that would have allowed us to hit a camp where Osama bin Laden was. We didn't feel there was any point in just carpet bombing without knowing exactly what was going on. We did have submarines that were armed with cruise missiles ready to go at any point that there was actionable intelligence. And President Clinton signed several executive orders saying that lethal force should be used against Osama bin Laden. I do think that had we done more, we would have been criticized for wagging the dog even more. And so I think that it's very hard, I think, to all of us to put ourselves back into the pre-9/11 mode when this was all viewed as something that we were making up. I had a very hard time after our embassies were bombed, and even though Americans died, it seemed too far away and we really couldn't get people that worked up about it. So it's a very hard issue, and I think we would have been criticized a lot if we had done more, but we were prepared to do more had there been something to act on. You can't just bomb without proper intelligence.
And do you think the quality of intelligence that you got and the Bush administration is getting is good enough?
Well, it's never good enough, I don't think. I mean, we're seeing that, but I don't fault so much the intelligence people. It's really hard, you know. I think that the places that we're looking at are very hard to penetrate. There had been in previous years, long before we came along, much more of emphasis on technical means of intelligence rather than human intelligence. And it's very hard to penetrate some of these societies that, in fact, are very family-centered, and they know who's there that's kind of looking into them. So I think we need to up the number of speakers who are Arabic speakers and have a much better level of intelligence. And clearly, there needs to be figured out how to do intelligence better.
Lou, thanks for calling in. Let me get Anne from Wilmington to join us. Anne, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, hello.
Hello.
I wanted to ask, it seems to me that actually the draft is a vitally important thing if we are in a war, because to have people disconnect who are running things disconnected from the troops, I think is really awful. I think everyone in this country needs to be invested in what's going on. And I think that the current army is composed of many people who are rather disadvantaged, and that's why they've gone into the army to better themselves.
Well, I per se am not, I mean, theoretically opposed to the draft. The question is how you avoid the kinds of problems that we had in Vietnam, where some people went and some people didn't go. The plan had always been is that the draft would be eliminated and it would be necessary to call up reserve forces, because then that would take an active decision by a president to show the political will to go forward. And so that was one of the kind of rationales. But the question is how you make the draft equitable. And I happen to actually believe that there needs to be more public service of a variety of kinds for people of that age in order to understand that we all have a stake in making this society function and to defend not only our freedom, but to make sure that other people don't suffer.
And thanks for calling in. Let me get Charles from Valley Forge. Charles, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, Mr. White, I think you're doing you did a great job under the Clinton administration, and I just can't believe I'm talking to you now.
Thank you.
Go ahead, though, Charles.
I wanted to ask about the Mideast. I know so much has been done, and I know how much you tried during your time with the secretary. And I guess first two-part question. One, do you believe there's sufficient willingness on all the parties at this point to create an environment for peace? And that's excluding the extremists or the radicals, just the willingness of all the state parties and the PLO and so forth, the Palestinian parties. And if you do believe there is such a willingness, what additionally will it take now to drive toward a peace?
Charles, thanks for the call, and I should add that you have a chapter in here entitled The Fruitless Quest, yeah, about the various negotiations.
Well, we spent so much time on this, and I think came very, very close. I think Arafat made a huge mistake when he didn't accept the best deal that he will ever, or the Palestinians will ever be offered. I do think that there is a group of people, both among the Palestinians and the Israelis, who want peace and who would like to figure out how to live some kind of a normal life. The question is how to bring them to the fore. What I find interesting, in the last few weeks, there have been some kind of informal plans that have been created by people outside the two governments who have gotten together to lay down some principles. So there's something going on there. What I think has to happen is the United States does have to be more actively involved. We spent a lot of time on it. We had a chief negotiator in the form of Dennis Ross, who had a complete memory of every discussion, so that if Arafat said, "I never agreed to that," he would say, "Yes, you did. We were sitting in this office. You were drinking tea. It was hot." And we don't, nothing like that exists at the moment. And the U.S. has to play that role. And But it's very hard. I think that the suicide bombings are a disaster, and extremists in both societies are further forward than these vast majorities of people who I think do want peace.
And do you think the wall is an impediment to peace or provides some kind of boundary for peace?
Well, I think it is a mixed issue because there clearly are some places where it works. But for me, it's an illusion of security. I don't know if you remember, Marty, there was a photograph on the front page of the New York Times several weeks ago where a woman was walking her dog in front of a piece of the wall that had been painted with the countryside so that it didn't look like a wall. And it reminded me of that movie Truman Show,
yes,
where there was this sense that you were living somewhere. And to me, it's then an illusion of security. And some of the discussions about where it should go and exclude whom and include whom, I think, creates a whole set of issues that complicate things.
You said the Clinton administration had a Dennis Ross. Does the Bush administration have their Dennis Ross, someone with this institutional memory about the Middle
East? Not really. I mean, the assistant secretary for the Near East, a man called Bill Burns, who also worked for me, is a remarkable person. But his portfolio extends from Morocco through Iran with a war in the middle of it. So even as brilliant as he is, it is impossible for him to do this. They have sent over a man, John Wolfe, who was an ambassador, to kind of monitor what's going on. But it's different from a peace team that we had. We were called the MEPIs, the Middle East Peace Team, that had this as their daily bread and knew every detail of the talks. And it requires also secretarial involvement. I can't say I was wild to get involved in the Middle East. I then went back and read Jim Baker's book, and he didn't want to be involved in the Middle East. And ultimately, the Secretary of State has to take this on as a personal issue along with the president.
So you're saying the Secretary of State, Colin Powell, needs to get more involved?
Well, it doesn't look at the moment as though this is one of his priorities. And in our case, you had President Clinton, who was really involved in every detail of it. I was, and we had Dennis Ross. So we had multiple people working on this issue, and it still was hard. So I think that there just needs to be more work. And this is not to say that it's easy. I think we all know the huge difficulties involved.
That was my 2003 interview with former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright. She died at the age of 84 in 2022. Joining me now in studio is WHYY executive producer Kevin McCrory. And Kevin has been helping me sort through the archives to make this Radio Times Rewind series. Hi, Kevin.
Hey, Marty. Great to be back.
Nice to have you back.
So Madeleine Albright.
Albright.
Really fascinating interview that kind of takes you in a portal back to 2003. Remember 2003?
I do, actually. Sadly.
And as you were listening back, like, what was going through your mind?
You know, there were several things. One that jumped out at me, and she was a little bit older than me, but this idea of being a woman, not sort of having a game plan, people sort of underestimating her abilities, even her underestimating herself. I thought that was really interesting and very disclosing.
Yeah, the personal stuff was definitely interesting. And, you know, she talked about, like, not really ever thinking she was going to be Secretary of State. And she kind of has this, you know, long PhD she talked about, and just kind of this career that built up in D.C. over the time in Democratic politics, and this relationship with her husband. Very fascinating. And
you never know with these public officials just how willing they will be to be a little personal. Obviously, the book was to some degree about her personal life growing up in Czechoslovakia, coming to the United States, being married and being basically told by her husband, it's over, I'm in love with somebody else. But that was a turning point for her, where she began to think of herself, putting herself first, and perhaps even began to put her career on the map for herself. So you never know, out of these really difficult situations, what can come out of them.
And just that interesting childhood and that backstory, what struck me too was, I mean, here's someone who grew up where, you know, Nazi Germany and, you know, Nazis coming into Czechoslovakia, and her dad being this strong proponent of democracy and, you know, rejecting the Communist Party that comes in. And it's almost this classic story of, like, an immigrant who sees the American experiment from afar and appreciates it and admires it maybe even more than the people in America do. And they come here and they inject some energy into it.
Well, they come here and she becomes the first woman to be Secretary of State of the United States. I mean, an extraordinary achievement. I know in the very beginning of the interview, I said, how come you don't have an accent? Which she didn't. And obviously growing up in Czechoslovakia, living in England, but she talked about how sort of shedding that accent was, I don't know if it was purposeful, but at the same time, something that she did maybe to Americanize herself. I mean, clearly she loved this country.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess one of the other things that really struck me was thinking about where we are in foreign policy now and how different the conversations are. And part of it does, it seems to me, go back to her childhood, where this idea of there's a lot of stuff going on in the world that can go very wrong very quickly. And the belief in a power like the United States to kind of play the global police, to intervene, to you know, step in when, in situations. And she was clearly very much a proponent for that, you know, an interventionalist. Maybe the critique of her these days would be globalist.
Right.
Right. Someone who is putting the interests of the world before the interests of the American people. I mean, she would argue, of course, that that is in the interest of the American people.
Yeah.
But just that whole conversation and having it in 2003, where the Iraq War is just beginning, Afghanistan had been going on a couple years, but it was before all that played out, right? And American politics seems to, especially foreign policy, change so much based on, I think, how long those conflicts went on.
Well, indeed. I mean, the war in Afghanistan, our longest war, and you look at what's going on in Afghanistan now after the U.S. pulled out. It's not an argument that we should have stayed, but nonetheless, look what life is like, especially for women living in Afghanistan. And in 2003, you know, the country was divided over this war in Iraq. We left Afghanistan, went to Iraq, thought we could sort of come in, bring democracy, everything would be all hunky-dory, and clearly it wasn't. So those lessons, either learned or not learned of that time, I think, in many ways influence how we view ourselves in the world, maybe how we're also viewed in the world.
And just like the overlap between the two parties, right? So, you know, Colin Powell, who you talked about in the interview, he stayed on in the Clinton administration, as a Republican. And Madeleine Albright, you know, was very much advocating for a lot of what happened in Iraq. Maybe she would have done it differently. Right. Maybe she would have had more, you know, multilateral agreements around it. But there was like a real cohesion almost even between the parties of, this is our role in the world. And when you think about what's happening in the Trump administration, it's just kind of a rejection of all of that.
I thought it was, again, 2003, so the very beginning of the internet.
Mm.
And she talked about this thing called the internet and how people were using it as a sort of new phenomenon. Of course, now the internet is front and forward. You don't exist unless you're on the internet. So I thought that was an interesting little, almost very old-fashioned view of public policy. And
there was a caller, I think, who was like, oh, the internet will come in and fix all this, right?
Exactly.
She was like, yeah, it's been very good so far.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, little did we know where the internet was going to take us. Radio Times Rewind is a WHYY special series on Sunday evenings. Kevin McCrory and I are the executive producers of the show. Our engineer is Al Banks. Next Sunday, my 1992 interview with South Philly-born music legend Bobby Rydell.